You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. The top four Republicans hoping to be Oregon's next governor shared a stage last week in Hillsboro. The event was billed as the first debate of the primary, but there wasn't a lot of disagreement among the four candidates. All four said Oregon's education system, housing crisis, and homelessness surge have worsened under Democratic Party rule. They pointed the finger at Governor Tina Kotek specifically.
Tina Kotek has led our state into a ditch.
That was Oregon State Senator Christine Drazen of Canby, the Republican Party's nominee in 2022. And here's 2010 GOP nominee Chris Dudley.
Every time Governor Kotek makes something a priority, it gets worse. Right? Housing, homelessness, drugs, schools.
State Representative Ed Deal of SIO and Marion County Commissioner Danielle Bethel also took part in the debate. The primary election is May 19th. So far this year, three gray whales have washed ashore along Oregon's beaches and nine in Washington. They're part of an alarming increase in whale strandings across the West Coast. OPB's April Ehrlich has more.
Every spring, gray whales migrate from their breeding grounds in Mexico to their feeding territory in the Bering Sea, north of Alaska. Whatever they ate last summer needs to last them through the 12,000-mile journey. This year, about 19 gray whales have washed ashore in California, Oregon, and Washington, and most have appeared emaciated. Michael Milstein is a spokesman with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
If we're seeing this many whales that are undernourished and having trouble this early in the year, what is that going to mean for the rest of the migration?
Milstein says the culprit may be melting Arctic ice. When there's less ice, there's less food for gray whales. Arctic ice has been melting rapidly due to global warming from burning fossil fuels. And I'm April Ehrlich reporting.
A federal judge has handed two attorneys steep fines for submitting error-ridden AI-generated court filings. The attorneys were representing a woman suing her brothers for ownership of Jacksonville's Valley View Winery. Judge Mark D. Clark levied $110,000 in penalties on the lawyers after discovering their filings included fake citations and made-up case law. The fine is likely the largest AI-related legal penalty so far in Oregon. The Oregon State Bar says it has seen a steep increase in ethics investigations involving attorneys using AI. Bar officials are currently working on guidance and training for lawyers on how to use the technology. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has vetoed a bill that would have changed state public meetings law. Alex Zielinski has more.
House Bill 4177 was meant to fix a 2023 law that made big changes to how public officials meet and communicate. Politicians across Oregon called that law far too vague and said it limited their ability to advance policy. But according to Kotek, the bill proposed earlier this year swings too far in the other direction. In a letter announcing her veto, Kotek said the legislation could be used by elected officials to circumvent transparency. Kotek asked the State Ethics Commission to work with lawmakers to improve the public meetings law next year. Groups representing Oregon journalists and newspaper publishers first called on Kotek to veto the bill after the legislature passed it last month. This is the only bill Kotek has vetoed this year. This is Alex Zielinski reporting.
It's been just over a year since the Fairfax Bridge in rural Pierce County was suddenly closed due to structural damage. This bridge has stood for over a century, and losing permanent access to it largely cut off aging residents living south of the bridge. Now they have to navigate a remote logging road to access everything from groceries to medical care. KNKX reporter Mitch Borden brings us the story.
On a rainy morning, Kent Taylor is struggling to unlock a large, heavy gate that's guarding a private dirt road.
Yeah, this thing's a little bit stiff and a little hard to do.
Dealing with this gate has become routine for people living south of the Fairfax Bridge. Ever since the bridge closed, there's been no way for the public to drive across the Carbon River Canyon, making this the only way residents can get in and out from their homes.
Some of the more ancient folks that live up there have problems with it. including myself.
Dozens of people own property deep in the forest back here. Many of them are seniors. That includes Taylor, who's 73, and his wife, 67-year-old Jill Cartwright. I hop in her car as she makes the drive to her house.
All right, you're going to close the gate?
I'll get the gate.
Thank you.
As Cartwright dodges potholes and inches along the narrow road, she recalls when the Fairfax Bridge closed. State officials shut down the bridge last year after finding a buckling support column and other damage. It happened suddenly. Cartwright had crossed it just hours before. Driving back, she found her way home barricaded off. She was shocked.
The first 6 months, I personally was like in fight or flight mode. Because we didn't know. We didn't know what was going to happen.
It could take the state 6 years to build a new bridge, and it could cost around $160 million. Officials are currently assessing whether to move forward with the project. So Cartwright and her neighbors are preparing to be on their own for a while. She's stocked up on supplies like fire extinguishers, bandages, and automatic defibrillators, AEDs for short. That's in case someone has a heart attack.
Nobody's going to be up here for an hour to help us. So we have 3 AEDs up here that we've gotten and asked for. So if we're close enough, we may be able to, you know, save somebody's life with the defibrillator.
A big part of Cartwright's preparations has been building relationships, like befriending a group of amateur radio operators who are visiting to help her install some radio equipment. Two-way radios have become an important part of communicating south of the bridge. One of the radio operators, Jamie Renwick, points out why.
There's no cell service out here. You know, you check your phone right now and there's nothing. It says no service.
You can make a phone call from certain spots, but locals need a more reliable way to reach emergency services. So Seth Ritchie, another radio operator, is working on installing an antenna up a tree to increase the broadcast range of their radios.
Climb all the way up into the top of up there and hopefully bring emergency communications into the community and make sure that if something were to go wrong, everyone can get help in a fast, efficient way.
76-year-old Mardell Chowan watches them work. She's lived out here for years and says it's been much more peaceful since the bridge closed. But the tranquility is bittersweet. Thousands of visitors used to pass through here on their way to remote sections of Mount Rainier National Park.
Hikers, bicyclists, families picnicking down along the river. There's just so much to do up here. And it's quieter, but I didn't mind the traffic because it meant people were going up to have fun.
One bright spot is that she's grown closer to her neighbors.
We're definitely more of a community, and we take care of each other. We know that now, you know. I'm not sure if we knew that before because, like I said, we're not all aligned with the same political spectrum.
Some locals fear that eventually they'll be forced to leave their homes. If a new bridge isn't built, the Washington State Department of Transportation may have to compensate residents if they lose access to their property, which could cost millions of dollars. That's only a possibility, but Chowan dreads the prospect of leaving.
My mother's ashes are spread up here. My ex-husband, my soulmate, I spread his ashes up here. This valley is a little special to me.
This is where Chowan wants to spend the rest of her life. And when she dies, she wants her ashes spread here too. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
This is local and regional news on KMUN. State Representative Cyrus Javity, who is running for re-election to his District 32 seat, pushed back at what he called a false and defamatory statement submitted for inclusion in an Oregon voter's pamphlet. His Republican challenger, Christian Honnell, called out Javity in a section of his statement titled, "The Politicians Have Failed Us." In this section, Honnell claimed that Javity, who switched from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party ahead of the filing deadline last year, quickly adopted a, quote, extreme far-left voting record. Honnell points to votes Javity made for a transportation funding bill and to prevent books from being removed from schools based on characters or authors' identities. Javity says Honnell's claims twist the truth. He also disagrees with the claim by Honnell that he boosted Planned Parenthood funding. Javidi says his vote instead restored cuts for basic health care services and did not, as Honnell says in his statement, quote, let abortion clinics leave babies born alive to die. Javidi says he filed a complaint with Oregon election officials requesting review of Honnell's statement to determine if it violates Oregon law on false and defamatory material in the voters' pamphlet. That pamphlet is slated to be published on Friday, but statements are already available online in a voter's guide for military and overseas voters, whose ballots went out ahead of others. The historian reached out to Honnell for comment, but did not receive a response. Most information in this story comes to us through a news partnership with The Historian, online at dailyhistorian.com. Tonight, the Astoria City Council will consider two possible locations for a designated campsite for unhoused people in the community. City leaders hope to model the campsite off a similar effort in Seaside called Stepping Stones. At a meeting earlier this month, the Astoria City Council established guiding criteria for possible sites, saying that, among other things, any campsite should either be close to services or have access to public transportation, cost no more than $200,000 to establish and set up, and have room for around 35 campers. The City Council said the campsite should not be located in a residential zoned area. The first potential site city staff identified is at the 2nd Street parking lot, where there has already been frequent unofficial camping. The proposal would be to convert half of the parking lot into a designated campsite. The site is currently owned by Pacific Power and Chevron, but is up for sale. The second proposed site is off Taylor Avenue, right by the roundabout at the Youngs Bay Bridge. This is property owned by the City of Astoria and the Oregon Department of Transportation. In a staff report, city staff said this site is the option that best aligns with the criteria established by the City Council and is already located on public property. Tonight's meeting begins at 6 p.m. in person at City Hall at 1095 Duane Street in Astoria and also on Zoom. More information is available at astoria.gov. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. If you have a news tip or story idea, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Or call us at 503-325-0010. Coming up next, a story from the American Homefront Project, followed by the American Democracy Minute. You're listening to KMUN. During the wars in Iran and Ukraine, armies are increasingly relying on so-called one-way attack drones, inexpensive unmanned devices that fly to their target and explode. But the U.S. is widely seen to be lagging other countries in developing and using them. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
That sound was already familiar across the U.S. military, which for years has been fielding small drones that let frontline ground troops see, for instance, what's over the next hill or inside a nearby tree line. More and more, though, that sound is going to be followed by this one. The Pentagon has begun a huge push to buy hundreds of thousands of small attack drones, the type that have long been the dominant weapon in Ukraine. Drones are responsible for about three-quarters of that war's casualties. This push was the subject of a recent hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, chaired by Republican Roger Wicker of Mississippi.
Both the American commercial drone industry and the Pentagon are years behind the curve in producing and employing drones. Catching up is as necessary as it is difficult, but I believe we're finally on the cusp of charting a future for American drone dominance.
In fact, drone dominance is the name of the Pentagon's new billion-dollar program to jumpstart mass production of small one-way attack drones. It's staging competitions among manufacturers and expects to buy 30,000 of the drones in the next few months and 300,000 next year. That still isn't a lot by the standards of the Ukraine war, says Katerina Bonder, who researches drone warfare at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Ukrainians produce 6 million drones per year.
She says the U.S. urgently needs large numbers of small attack drones for training and to learn how to integrate them into the way that forces fight. So think of that 300,000 as expendable.
You can treat them as bullets, basically. That's how they do it in Ukraine.
She says the Pentagon's drone buying initiative is a good first step, but just as important is teaching the troops to use them.
If you talk to Ukrainian military, they would tell you that despite all the cool software, AI, and you know all this kind of stuff, 80% of strike mission success depends on drone operator skills. How to integrate them, how to actually fight with them, this is something valuable, and it's really hard to buy for money. So there is a lot of work has to be done.
Some units are already doing that work.
So more or less, the training is focused on integrating the unmanned aerial systems into realistic combat scenarios.
Captain Andrew Cannon is a company commander with the 1st Battalion, 2nd Marine Regiment out of Camp Lejeune. He was speaking from a California base where his unit was doing realistic combat training to help the Marines figure out how to incorporate small attack drones, hoping to build lessons to share across the Marine Corps. His unit is using the Neros Archer, which is one of the first selected so far in the Pentagon competition. Not much bigger than a dinner plate, it looks much like the kind hobbyists use. He says the Marines using it are enthusiastic about the new capabilities it gives them.
It gives us lethality and precision. It gives small unit leaders the ability to apply force in a very controlled and deliberate way. It allows us to be very effective while reducing risk to the Marines with that standoff that it allows. I'd say a big increase in lethality at the squad level.
Some senators at the committee hearing spoke of the quest for drone dominance as a watershed moment in warfare, with Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal equating it to the nuclear arms race or the early days of space exploration. Meanwhile, Bonder, the drone expert, notes that other countries are continuing to advance. For instance, she says Russia, which was already using AI to automate how its drones pick targets, now has begun experimenting with fully autonomous systems that cut human operators out of decisions about what to attack. I'm Jay Price reporting.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. John Eastman, the alleged architect of the effort to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election in Congress, had his disbarment upheld by the California Supreme Court April 15th. His attorney says Eastman will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Vice Chair of the January 6th committee, Representative Liz Cheney, explained in a hearing, but President Trump plotted with a lawyer named John Eastman to pressure Pence to do so anyway. As a federal court has explained, based on the evidence, the court finds that it is more likely than not that President Trump and Dr. Eastman dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021, unquote. Eastman was tried on 11 counts of misconduct in the State Bar Court of California in June 2023, arising from his activities surrounding his representation of President Donald Trump and the 2020 presidential election. He was disbarred and appealed to the state Supreme Court. While he was pardoned by the president in November 2025, that pardon doesn't extend to the state disciplinary action. A statement by Eastman's lawyer to NBC4 Los Angeles indicated Eastman would appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Eastman had previously been disbarred in Washington, D.C. in 2024. We've linked to more on John Eastman's alleged role in the overturning of the 2020 election at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.